education, more than just posting inspirational slogans throughout classrooms and having school principals deliver lofty weekly sermons during assembly. Rather, they're trying to make it an integral part of the daily learning experience of all their students and equally of their teachers and mentors. I asked Dave how KIPP manages to make character education tangible to give it teeth in the classroom. He believes the key is to give students the opportunity to practice in school the critical behaviors that nurture self-control, grit, and other character skills. In his words, if you want kids to learn how to get over frustrations quickly, bounce back from failures, and work independently with focus, they have to be given the chance to do these things in their academic classes, and the teachers need to structure their lessons to allow time for this. Therefore, the curriculum provides substantial time for practice in which students work independently, with a partner, or in a small team, but independent of the teacher, on challenging projects that demand concentration and sustained effort. Quote, the key is that the teacher is no longer standing in front of the class talking, but rather forcing kids to do the heavy lifting, close quote. To monitor their progress in character education, students evaluate themselves several times a year at the end of each marking period. They evaluate how often, from almost never to almost always, they successfully practiced a set of behaviors that define each character skill, specifically self-control, grit, optimism, zest, social intelligence, curiosity, and gratitude. Each skill is linked to the defining behaviors with phrases like, I stayed motivated even when things didn't go well, for optimism, and I finished whatever I began, for grit. Self-control is divided into two types of self-discipline. The ability to keep goals in mind and stay focused when working, I paid attention and resisted distractions, and the ability to control temper and frustration in upsetting interpersonal situations. I remained calm even when criticized or otherwise provoked. For zest, the behavioral features are items like I approached new situations with excitement and energy, and social intelligence is defined with behaviors like I demonstrated respect for the feelings of others. The teachers are asked to observe and rate the progress not only of their students but also of themselves on similar measures of character development to assess the progress of the entire school community and guard against decline. These efforts to enhance character skills have not yet been systematically evaluated, but the children and teachers in these programs are at least beginning to think and talk in this language about whether they're successfully building the desired character skills. As I learned about the character skills that KIPP is working hard to develop in its students, I was struck by their similarity to the qualities that differentiated the preschool children who were able to wait on the marshmallow test from those who quickly rang the bell when we looked at them as adolescents a decade later, as discussed in Chapter 1. Take grit, for example, which is measured on Angela Duckworth's grit scale with items like setbacks don't discourage me. This statement is almost verbatim one of the qualities that parents said characterized their adolescent children who waited longer on the marshmallow test in preschool. It is encouraging to see the overlap in the behaviors and attitudes that distinguished high-delay children as they grew up and the character skills that KIPP is trying to enhance in its students to improve their chance for a successful future. For many reasons, schools like KIPP often start in kindergarten and not in the earlier preschool years when children are highly vulnerable and the biology of disadvantage lays down its roots. Preschool is also the time when children are most ready to learn strategies that can help them cope with stress and develop cognitive skills essential for school success to help narrow the ever-growing achievement gap between the well-off and the poor. President Obama called for making preschool education universally available in the United States in his 2013 State of the Union address. If this call to action translates into reality, the success of the effort will depend in part on how effectively preschools incorporate lessons from the research into their work. And while preschools can help provide the essential foundations, long-term gains will depend on how schools and families collaborate to help children continue to use and further develop skills to generate the conscientious behaviors, self-control, responsibility, and life goals that society values. It remains to be seen how the Obama proposal for universal access to preschool in the United States will fare. But there is good reason to believe that better access to preschool, however it can be accomplished, is urgently needed, and to hope and advocate that if it materializes, these schools will help young children develop the character skills and motivation they need to have the chances they deserve. 19. Applying core strategies. The self-control concepts and strategies in this chapter will not be news to you since I discussed research about each of them throughout this book. In this chapter, I put them together, show how they connect, summarize key points, and focus explicitly on how they can be applied in everyday life to help with self-control efforts, when and if you want to try them out. To begin with, resisting temptation is difficult because the hot system is heavily biased toward the present. It takes full account of immediate rewards, but discounts rewards that are delayed. Psychologists have demonstrated this future discounting in both humans and animals, and economists have formalized it in a simple mathematical model. David Labson, a Harvard University economics professor and my colleague in ongoing research, has used it to explain why he rarely makes it to the gym in spite of his good intentions to go there regularly. Individuals differ in how severely they discount the future. And his example uses a discount rate that cuts the value of delayed rewards in half. For most people, the discount is even larger. In order to model the discounting, Labson assigns a number value to each activity, rating how much pain or effort, negative number, or how much reward, positive number, the activity provides. For him, the effort of exercising today has a cost of -6. And the long-term health gains from exercise have a positive value of +8. Of course, these numbers always depend on the values of the individual making the decision. This is how Labson explains his procrastination. He can exercise today, his effort cost is -6, to gain delayed health benefits, for him a future value of +8. The net benefit for exercising today, for someone with his present bias, is -6 plus 1/2 of 8, which equals -2. In this equation, the future value of +8 was halved because of the automatic discounting of the future, making -2 the net benefit of his exercising today. In contrast, exercising tomorrow has a delayed effort cost of -6, and a delayed benefit of +8, both of which are halved because they are in the future. 1/2 of -6 +8, which equals +1. For Labson, the resulting net value for putting off going to the gym is +1, which is better than the -2 net value for exercising today. Consequently, he is rarely at the gym. These weightings vary a great deal, not only among individuals, but also within each of us for different activities. You may religiously make it to the gym, but always avoid cleaning your closet. The emotional brain's predisposition to overvalue immediate rewards and to greatly discount the value of delayed rewards points to what we need to do if we want to take control. We have to reverse the process by cooling the present and heating the future. The successful preschoolers demonstrated how to do this. They cooled their immediate temptation by physically distancing themselves from it. They pushed it to the outer edge of the table, turned around in their chairs to face the other direction, and invented imaginative ways to purposefully distract themselves, all while keeping their goal, 2 marshmallows, in mind. In experiments in which we suggested cooling strategies to help them delay for the larger rewards, they cooled the immediate temptation by transforming it cognitively, rendering it more abstract and psychologically distant, which made self-control much easier for them and let them wait longer than we could even bear to watch. The fundamental principle, cool the now, heat the later. Regardless of age, the core strategy for self-control is to cool the now and heat the later. Push the temptation in front of you far away in space and time, and bring the distant consequences closer in your mind. My colleagues and I demonstrated this in the experiments with tobacco and food cravings described in Chapter 10. When we cued participants to focus on later and the long-term consequences of eating, I may get too fat, they experienced reduced food cravings, both in what they felt and in what their brains registered. Likewise, when heavy smokers focused on later and the long-term consequences of cigarette smoking, I may get lung cancer, their tobacco cravings diminished. Focusing on now and the immediate short-term effect, it will feel good. Of course, had the opposite effect, making the cravings impossible to resist. Outside the lab, when our hot system makes us focus on the present temptation in life, there's no one to cue us to make the distant consequences hot and the immediate gratifications cool. To master self-control, we have to instruct ourselves, and that won't happen naturally because in the face of temptations, the hot system dominates. It discounts delayed consequences. It activates faster than the cool system, and as it accelerates, the cool system attenuates. This dominance of the hot system might have served our ancestors well in the wild, but it also drives us to the default reflex of giving in to temptations, making it easy for smart people to behave stupidly. If we feel regret about our self-control failures, it will probably be fleeting because our psychological immune system is so good at protecting and defending us, rationalizing our lack of self-control. I had a crazy day. It was her fault. And not letting us feel bad about ourselves for long. That makes it even more unlikely that we will learn to behave differently in the future. If then implementation plans make self-control automatic. How do we get around this problem? If we want to exert self-control, we have to find ways to activate the cool system automatically when we need it, which is exactly when this is hardest to do unless we have prepared for it. Recall how the young kids resisted the seductive Mr. Clownbox, who kept urging them to come talk and play with him now rather than continue their work and play later, Chapter 5. They prepared for the encounter by first rehearsing if-then implementation plans. For example, if Mr. Clownbox makes that bzzzt sound and asks you to look at him and play with him, then you can just look at your work, not him, and say, "No, I can't, I'm working." Such if-then plans help the children stick to their goals, persist in their work, and resist Mr. Clownbox's beguiling temptations. In life, employing if-then implementation plans has helped adults and children control their own behavior more successfully than they had imagined possible. If we have these well-rehearsed plans in place, the self-control response will become automatically triggered by the stimulus to which it is connected. If I approach the fridge, then I will not open the door. If I see a bar, then I will cross to the other side of the street. If my alarm goes off at 7 a.m., then I will go to the gym. The more often we rehearse and practice implementation plans, the more automatic they become, taking the effort out of effortful control. Find the if for if-then plans. The first step in creating an if-then plan is to identify the hot spots that trigger the impulsive reactions you want to control. In the Wadiko Camp Studies, Chapter 15, the researchers looked not just at how much aggression the children expressed, but also at the psychological situations in which they did and did not express it. Rather than being broadly consistent across many different kinds of situations, problematic behaviors were highly contextualized and depended on the specific type of situation. While Anthony and Jimmy, for example, had similar overall average levels of aggression, the hot spots that triggered each of their outbursts were completely different. Anthony was explosive if interacting with peers, even if they were nice to him, while Jimmy lost control if interacting with adults, but not with his peers, even if they teased and provoked him. One way to identify our own hotspots is to keep a journal to track moments when we've lost control, similar to the self-monitoring I described in Chapter 15, to track stress reactions. People track the specific psychological events that triggered their daily stresses, identifying each situation in which their stress occurred and noting its intensity. Their hotspots were usually more specific than they had expected them to be. Recall that Jenny, for example, discovered that she had stress levels no higher than average in most situations, and often they were below average. Her stress levels were only extremely high in situations in which she felt excluded. That is when she fell apart, full of anger at others as well as at herself. Once we identify our precise hotspots, for example by tracking them as they're triggered, we can begin to form and practice specific if-then implementation plans to change how we cope with them. For rejection-sensitive Bill, featured in Chapter 12, an especially troubling situation that triggered his anger was when he felt his wife focused on the newspaper rather than on him at breakfast. He could practice implementation plans for this scenario so that when she turned to the headlines, he automatically activated a cooling strategy to self-distract, such as silently counting down from 100 until he had calmed enough to inhibit the destructive outburst he was about to have. He could then substitute a constructive alternative. Please pass me the business section, thereby helping himself step by step to maintain the relationship he was afraid to lose. It sounds simplistic, but it can be astonishingly effective in actual practice, as Peter Gollwitzer and Gabrielle Ettingen have repeatedly documented in their research. The hard part is maintaining the change over time, which is true for most efforts to enhance self-control, from dieting to giving up cigarettes. If we persist, however, the gratification that our new behavior produces will help sustain it. The new behavior itself becomes valued, no longer a burden, but a source of satisfaction and self-confidence. As with all efforts to change long-standing patterns and learn new ones, whether playing the piano or exercising self-restraint to avoid hurting the people we love, the prescription is to practice, practice, practice until it becomes automatic and intrinsically rewarding. Plans sure to fail. When people anticipate that they will not be able to control themselves, they often try to make pre-commitments to reduce the temptations in their environment. They strip the house of the irresistible foods that are bad for them, get rid of the liquor, or throw away their stashes of cigarettes, and resolve not to buy more of the tempting products. Or if they do buy them, they do so in smaller, more expensive quantities in the hope that this will make them too costly to afford. Pre-commitment strategies, from Christmas savings clubs to insurance policies and pension plans, can be relatively low-cost ways to reap valuable benefits. But when these strategies are tried without a binding commitment, without a specific if-then implementation plan to give them teeth, they're likely to go the way of New Year's resolutions. We are wonderfully creative at making tepid commitments and then finding endless ways to get around them. I saw this play out with a friend and colleague, now long deceased. He was a renowned research psychologist who was half-heartedly trying to cut down his incessant smoking by using the pre-commitment strategy of refusing to buy any cigarettes. Instead, he mooched them from anyone nearby. At Christmas time, the offices at Columbia University were mostly empty, and this restricted his efforts. But in his desperation, he began searching for cigarette butts on the sidewalks of Manhattan. He described to me his greatest moment of shame. He had at last detected a cigarette butt on Broadway that looked tempting, and he stooped down to get it. As he rose with the butt in his hand, he saw the look on the face of the street person who was always on that corner. The street person had been reaching to pick up the same butt but was not fast enough, and now exclaimed to my elegantly attired friend, "I don't expletive believe it." My friend illustrated how to make pre-commitments that are guaranteed to fail. even though he was more than smart enough to understand this himself. Instead of enlisting other people to help him stick to his ostensible goal, telling them to refuse to give him cigarettes no matter how much he begged, their polite responses to his mooching helped him fail. He was fully aware that in order to fight the power of the immediate temptation to smoke, he would have to make the costs of violating his pre-commitment to quit much greater than the value of getting his cigarette immediately when his hot system wanted it, which was most of the time. As psychotherapists, whatever their orientation and strategies, regularly tell their clients, you have to want to change, with emphasis on the want to. Pre-commitment plans that can work. To make pre-commitment strategies work, turn them into if-then implementation plans. Many examples can be found in cognitive behavior therapy. In my friend's situation, he would have had to pre-commit by leaving huge checks made out to his most hated causes, of which he had many, with a binding contract authorizing his therapist to mail one check each time a cigarette was mooched or smoked. If this is a strategy you want to try without a therapist, you can ask an accountant, lawyer, closest enemy, or best friend to mail your checks. The steep discounting of future rewards takes a tragic toll on everything from health care to retirement planning. Millions of people in the United States, for example, are shocked at how little they have saved when their distant future self becomes their present self at age 65, as discussed in Chapter 9. Recognizing the scope and seriousness of this problem, researchers have helped employers bypass the limitations of human self-control by making retirement savings the default option when new employees sign on to their firms. At one large firm, the rate of participation in the 401k retirement plan after 1 year of service was 40% when non-enrollment was the default. When the default was enrollment or required action to opt out, it was 90%. If we don't have such forward-looking employers, we can try in our halcyon days to connect more closely with our future selves, to keep who and what we're trying to become in mind, to construct a life story that has continuity and direction and long-term goals that become visible, not just when looking back, but also when looking ahead. At the concrete action level, we can use implementation plans to nudge ourselves and select the option to save the highest percent we can afford for the retirement plan, to be initiated the day we are eligible to sign on at a new job. Or if we are still at the old job, we can implement a plan to check in with human resources on Monday morning at 10 a.m. to be sure that the right retirement savings option is in place and saving for us automatically. Such strategies can help us get around the discounting equation, assuming that the retirement plan does not default by the time we need it and that we are still around to use it. Cognitive reappraisal. It's not a treat. It's poison. In part one, we saw that how the preschoolers mentally represented the temptations determined how well they could control themselves. When they reappraised their hot temptations to cool them down, they were able to wait for the delayed treats. 20 years later, I had a eureka moment in which I suddenly realized the meaning of those findings in my own life. This was in 1985, but it is still as vivid as if it were yesterday. A terrible itchy rash had erupted around both elbows, as painful as if I had dipped them in acid. It kept spreading and getting worse. And after a year of agony, I found a well-known dermatologist who explained that my problem was a version of celiac disease. The prescription he gave me would help manage it, and I would have to take it indefinitely. He cautioned that frequent blood tests were needed to monitor against the possibly serious side effects of the medication. I soon improved, but a milder version of the rash persisted. After many months, I learned from the medical school library, this was before Google and easy internet research, that while little was known about celiac disease at the time, it was due to an autoimmune reaction to gluten contained in wheat, barley, and rye. A gluten-free diet was the only cure. Although the drug my physician gave me could alleviate the symptoms, it would not prevent the long-term destructive effects of the disease. I asked my dermatologist why he had not told me that I should be on a gluten-free diet. Nobody has the self-control needed to stay on a gluten-free diet in a gluten-filled world, he said, so there was no point in talking about it. A quarter of a century later, it turns out that a great many people all over the world are being diagnosed with celiac disease, and lots of them, myself included, are managing to stay on gluten-free diets. People are able to do this not because they are exceptionally good at self-control, but because the news that gluten is toxic for them has shifted the reward values in their discounting equation. Previously irresistible temptations like chocolate fudge cakes, French baguettes, and pasta Alfredo have suddenly become their poison. The fact that the consequences of merely tasting anything with gluten usually come quickly, surely, and painfully to those with celiac disease, of course, makes the transformation much easier, almost automatic. For behaviors like foregoing tobacco, dieting, controlling one's temper, or saving one's income for retirement rather than spending it, the negative consequences are in the distant future and probabilistic rather than swift and certain. They are abstract, unlike a painful burning itch or gastrointestinal distress. Therefore, you have to reappraise them to make them concrete. Visualize your lungs with cancer on an x-ray the doctor is showing you as he gives you the bad news, and imagine the future as if it were the present. Self-distancing, stepping out of the self. The best self-control plans notwithstanding, anger, anxiety, rejection, pain, and other negative emotions are inevitable parts of life. Consider the heartbreak of people who are rejected by a partner or spouse after years of building a committed life together, Chapter 11. Many people who have been hurt this way keep reliving their terrible experiences, refueling their sadness, anger, and resentment, and depressing themselves more deeply. As their stress increases, the hot system becomes even more dominant, deactivating the cool system and triggering a vicious cycle. Increased stress leads to hot system dominance, leads to negative emotions, leads to long-term distress, leads to deepening depression, leads to loss of control, leads to chronic stress, leads to increasingly toxic psychological and biological consequences, leads to increased stress. To get out of this trap, it can help to temporarily suspend the habitual self-immersed view we have of ourselves and the world. You look again at the painful experience, not through your own eyes, but as if you were observing from a distance, like a fly on the wall, observing what happened to a third party. This change in perspective alters how the experience is appraised and understood. By increasing your psychological distance from the event, you reduce stress, cool the hot system, and can use the prefrontal cortex to reappraise what happened so that you can make sense of it, gain closure, and move on. The mechanisms that enable these changes are still being studied, but the shift from self-immersion to self-distancing significantly reduces psychological and biological distress and lets us regain better control of our thoughts and feelings. That makes the mental acrobatics of becoming the observant fly on the wall worth a try. It is not easy to do by yourself. But cognitive behavior therapy uses many of the principles and findings discussed throughout this book to help with the toughest struggles. This type of therapy can be especially useful when one's own self-control efforts fail, as they did in John Cheever's story, The Angel of the Bridge. When the hot system has formed intense anxiety-producing associations that are triggered automatically, it generates disabling panic. Without help, these negative associations can resist even the best self-control efforts, unless we're lucky enough to meet our own angel of the bridge. What can parents do? At the end of every talk I give in schools, after I emphasize that self-control is far from completely pre-wired, parents ask, "What can we do to help our children?" When there's enough time, I begin telling them that it is especially important to keep stress levels low during pregnancy and in the infant's first few years. It is well known that exposure to extreme and prolonged stress early in life can be terribly damaging. More surprising is that children who live with seemingly mild chronic stressors in their first year of life, like exposure to persistent, albeit nonviolent, parental conflict, may experience increased stress reactions in their brain simply when they hear angry voices while they're sleeping. To keep infants' stress levels low, a first step for parents might be to try to reduce their own stress, recognizing that it often increases when newborns arrive. The same strategies that cool and control hot system reactions to impulses, temptations, and rejection experiences apply when dealing with crying and needy infants every few hours in the middle of the night, especially when you're exhausted yourself. Beginning in the first year, caretakers can use distraction strategies to turn the child's attention away from feelings of distress and focus instead on diverting stimuli and activities. In time, the young child learns to control her attention to reduce her own distress by self-distracting, a basic step for developing executive function. Parents can be helpful guides in this transition. Bruce, a writer who worked at home, spent much of his time caring for his 4-year-old son. Once when the boy was waiting for his favorite television program, and it refused to come on screen when he wanted it to, he dissolved in a temper tantrum. Bruce had heard about the marshmallow research and how self-distraction helps kids wait for their treats, so he decided to try it with his son. He calmed his son down and suggested that there were ways to make waiting much easier. Just distract yourself and do other fun things in your head or for real until the program comes on. His son then picked up his favorite toys, moved away from the television set, and played happily until his program appeared. Bruce was surprised at how easy it was and delighted when he saw that his son seemed to have learned from this experience as he continued to use self-distraction to make delay more manageable in other situations. Distraction won't work when young kids are hurting one another, especially when the caretakers are not close by. Elizabeth is a licensed practicing therapist and counselor who is well-trained in cognitive behavior therapy and often works with children who are having self-control struggles and with their parents. I asked her for examples of strategies she uses to help preschoolers control aggressive behavior, and she gave me some tips from her efforts to help her own son, who was 3 at the time. She told me he was biting sometimes up to 3 kids a day at school. After trying many strategies, what finally worked was a very simple, boys who bite do not get dessert policy. So I'd pick him up at school, find out if he had bitten. If so, then no dessert that night. We talked about it ahead of time, rehearsed it again on the way to school, and on the first day, he heard me tell his teachers the policy before I left. When I got to school to pick him up, he had had one biting incident near the very end of the day. I told him, okay, no dessert tonight. He said, okay, Mama, and we hugged. When we got home, I showed him the dessert I had made. I reminded him that if he did no biting the next day, he could have some that evening. He understood. Each time there was an incident, we'd brainstorm alternative strategies and think of things he could do instead of biting. We'd practice on the way to school. Whenever he used an alternative strategy, I used my words, Mama, I'd praise him for making good choices. In 3 or 4 days, he was bite-free, and since then there have been no further incidents. Elizabeth's example highlights the importance of helping children learn early on that they have choices, and that each choice has consequences. It also illustrates that rewards can be used judiciously to encourage appropriate choices. What those rewards should be depends on the parent's values and what will work for the particular child. Parents who want to avoid using food as rewards, for example, can easily find other treats and experiences. The self-control strategies that children develop are shaped by their attachment experiences with caretakers from the start of life. Parents who hope to raise children who will stay closely attached to them but also develop adaptive self-control skills can improve their chances through their own behavior. If they're sensitive to their toddler's needs, provide support and help when it's wanted, but also encourage autonomy, their odds will be better than those of parents who intrusively over-control their children or are more focused on their own needs than on their children's, Chapter 4. To promote children's sense of both autonomy and responsibility, we can help them realize early in life that they do have choices that are theirs to make, and that each choice comes with consequences. Good choices lead to good consequences. Bad choices lead to bad consequences. Recall George Ramirez, who felt lost and adrift in his chaotic life as a young child in the South Bronx, and then went on to become a successful student at Yale University. He dated the beginning of his own saved life to the time at age 9 when he learned his first lesson about the causal connection between his choices and their consequences. On his first day at KIPP, George began to see that he actually had choices, that it was up to him to make them, and that it was his responsibility to deal with their consequences. It was the teacher's responsibility to make sure that his choices resulted in the consequences they deserved. It was the same if-then lesson that Elizabeth taught her young son about biting other kids. Children who bite don't get dessert. George's lesson was that third graders who don't listen don't learn. And if I'm polite to others, they're polite to me. Chapter 8. Parents can do much to create conditions in which their young children succeed. One important strategy involves working with them on enjoyable but challenging tasks that become increasingly difficult, whether it's learning to play the piano, building with blocks and Legos, or climbing on the jungle gym. The challenge for parents is to provide the support their child needs and wants, and then let her work on her own without taking over and doing it for her. Early success experiences help young children develop optimistic, reality-based expectations for success and competence, and prepare them to discover for themselves the kinds of activities that ultimately become intrinsically gratifying for them. Chapter 8. We can also help children develop incremental growth mindsets in which they think of their talents, abilities, intelligence, and social behavior not as reflecting inborn traits, but as skills and competencies that they can cultivate if they invest the effort. Rather than looking for good grades and applauding kids for being so smart, we can praise them for trying as hard as they can. As Carol Dweck's research discussed in Chapter 8 illustrated, guiding children to think about their abilities and intelligence as malleable skills prepares them to use effort to improve their performance. Just as important, we can help them understand and accept that failures along the route are part of life and learning, and then encourage them to find constructive ways to deal with such setbacks so that they keep trying instead of becoming anxious, depressed, and avoidant. And if we want them to be willing to delay gratification when we promise them delayed rewards, we'd better be careful to keep our promises. But arguably, the best answer to the "what can we do to help our children" question is to model what you would like them to become. How parents and other important figures in a child's life do or do not control themselves, how they deal with stress, frustrations, and emotions, the standards they use in evaluating their own achievements, their empathy and sensitivity to other people's feelings, their attitudes, goals, and values, their disciplinary strategies, their lack of discipline, all profoundly influence the child. Parents model and teach children an enormous repertoire of possible reactions to endless challenges from which children select and transform what fits and works uniquely for them over the course of their own development. Much research has shown the powerful effects of models, even in short-term experiments, on everything from navigating aggressive feelings in preschool to overcoming a fear of dogs, to recovering from heart surgery, to avoiding unsafe sex. In preschool experiments, for example, when friendly adult models scolded and beat up a Bobo doll at Stanford University's Bing Nursery School, the preschoolers who had watched them imitated their aggressive behavior in exquisite detail later when they were left to play by themselves, and even added their own elaborations. Likewise, when models rewarded their own performance in a bowling game only when their scores were very high and cued the children they played with to do likewise, they strongly affected the self-reward patterns and achievement standards that the kids adopted for themselves later, when bowling by themselves in the model's absence. Stories about what happens to fictional children, beloved animals like baby bears and cuddly tigers, and animated locomotives who do all kinds of constructive and destructive things that lead to different consequences teach young children lessons about good and bad behavior that they love to hear over and over, again and again. Preschoolers don't know that these bedtime stories and televised educational programs are teaching them executive function. Different characters enact themed stories, imparting positive social and emotional values, including how to cope with sadness, how to use words instead of actions to deal with anger, how to be a good friend, how to express gratitude, and how to delay gratification. These books and programs can help young children learn to deal with stress and interpersonal conflicts and develop executive function, all through a medium they enjoy. Regardless of how the strategies are learned, children are fortunate if by ages 4 and 5 they know and use methods that make it increasingly easy and automatic for them to cool their hot systems when they need to, whether it is by playing happily by themselves or waiting for bigger treats on the marshmallow test. But I can't end this discussion without reiterating. A life lived with too much delay of gratification can be as sad as one lived without enough of it. The biggest challenge for all of us, not just for the child, may be to figure out when to wait for more marshmallows and when to ring the bell and enjoy them. But unless we learn to develop the ability to wait, we don't have that choice. 20. Human nature. Your future in a marshmallow. When I first saw this header about my research posted on the internet, it was the stimulus that prompted me to start writing this book. I Googled the phrase as I began this final chapter, and it led me to, "Fate may not be written in the stars, but what if it's written in our genes?" The research in this book tells a story that leads to very different conclusions than this tagline suggests. It is a story of how self-control can be nurtured in children and adults so that the prefrontal cortex can be used deliberately to activate the cool system and regulate the hot system. The skills that enable this give us the freedom to escape from stimulus control to achieve self-control, thereby giving us real choice, instead of being pushed by the immediate impulses and pressures of the moment. A main lesson from modern science is that rather than being predestined by DNA and development in the uterus, the architecture of our brains is more malleable than had been imagined, and we can have an active hand in shaping our fates by how we live our lives. While many, indeed most preschoolers who managed to delay gratification on the marshmallow test continued to show good self-control for decades to come, self-control steadily decreased for some, whereas others who rang the bell soon showed the opposite pattern over the years, increasing their self-regulation as they matured. This book tries to make sense of that variability, to convey its complexity, and points to some of the choices in the course of development that influence how life unfolds. EF and burning goals. The children who persisted in the marshmallow test could not have done it without their well-developed EF. Their executive function. A second critical ingredient for their success was the motivation to sustain their effort, or grit. For what must have felt like an eternity, they kept using their minds and imaginations, shifting their attention and waiting for the adult to come back without ringing the bell. Two marshmallows or cookies or whatever they chose became their burning goal, strong enough to sustain a heroic effort and make it feel worthwhile. Outside the surprise room, the wish list for those we love must surely include a hope that they will discover, stumble into, or create their own burning goals to motivate them to construct the lives they want. Bruce Springsteen found his goal when he saw himself in a mirror for the first time holding his new guitar. George Ramirez says he found his the first day he spent as a student at KIPP. Mark Owen discovered his in junior high school when he happened to open Men in Green Faces, written by a Navy SEAL, and realized in a flash that that was what he had to become. Dave Levin says that when he started teaching, he knew at last why he was put on Earth. We all have our story, and we can keep editing it as it unfolds over time, as we look back to figure out what those goals must have been, even if we did not know we had them, or look ahead to puzzle out where we seem to be going. When I was very young, my least favorite uncle was successful in the umbrella manufacturing business and eager to have me join him. He kept torturing me with questions about what I wanted to be when I grew up, hoping that I would say I wanted to be just like him. For me, that defined exactly what I did not want to be, and instead got me thinking about what I might want to make of myself. Another psychologist, a lifelong colleague and friend, who has had one of the most brilliant and successful careers in the history of psychology, attributes his burning goal to his father. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, his father chose to forego his own ambitions for higher education and achievement, to work tirelessly so that his family could survive and thrive. My friend attributes his success to having been driven to make and live the life his father was willing to give up as a tribute in his honor. It became his mission in life. Self-control skills are essential for pursuing our goals successfully, but it is the goals themselves that give us direction and motivation. They are important determinants of life satisfaction, and those that we select early in life have striking effects both on the later goals that we reach and the satisfaction we feel about our lives. No matter how they're formed, the goals that drive our life stories are as important as the EF we need to try to reach them. Self-control, especially when it is labeled effortful control, can sound as if it demands a grim commitment to very tough, trying labor, a voluntary entry into a work-driven life of self-denial, of living for the future and missing the pleasures of the moment. An acquaintance told me about a recent dinner he had with friends in Manhattan, during which the topic turned to the marshmallow test. One of his friends, a novelist who lived in Greenwich Village, was contrasting his own life with that of his brother, a very wealthy and successful investment banker living the pinstriped suit with Hermes necktie life. The brother had long been married and had children who were all doing well. The writer had published 5 novels, but they had had little impact and few sales. He described himself, nevertheless, as having a great time, spending his days writing and living the bachelor life at night, going from one short-term relationship to the next. He speculated that his solemn, straight-laced brother probably would have waited forever for his marshmallows, whereas he would have been an early bell ringer. In fact, the novelist could not have published those 5 books without a great deal of self-control, and he probably also needs it when trying to maintain his fun relationships while staying uncommitted. Nor did he manage to make it through an elite liberal arts college that emphasizes creative writing without having more than enough self-control to do so. You need EF as much for a creative life in the arts as for a successful life in anything else. It's just the goals that differ. Without EF, the chance to find and pursue your goals is lost. That's what kids in the South Bronx faced if they lost in the Kip lottery. But without compelling goals and drive, EF can leave us competent but aimless. Alternative views of who we are. Your reactions to the research findings on brain plasticity and the malleability of behavior in this book depend importantly on your own beliefs about how much people can really control and change what they become. There are 2 conflicting ways to interpret what these findings tell us in the larger context of who we are and what we can be. It is worth using your cool system to think about what the results mean to you before coming to firm conclusions that your hot system has probably already reached. The answer to the question of whether human nature is, at its core, malleable or fixed, has been an enduring concern of not just scientists, but more important, each of us in our everyday lives. Some people see self-control ability, willpower, intelligence, and other characteristics as fixed, unchangeable traits from the very start of life. They read the experimental evidence that executive function and self-control improve after educational interventions and interpret that as short-term effects unlikely to make a long-term difference, just little tricks that don't change inborn traits. These people differ from those who see the evidence as supporting the view that we are open to change and able to alter how we think and behave, that we can craft our own lives, rather than being either the winners or the losers in the DNA lottery. If we allow the evidence to make a difference to our personal theories, the discovery of the plasticity of the brain tells us that human nature is more flexible and open to change than has been long assumed. We do not come into the world with a bundle of fixed, stable traits that determine who we become. We develop in continuous interactions with our social and biological environments. These interactions shape our expectations, the goals and values that drive us, the ways we interpret stimuli and experience, and the life stories we construct. To reiterate from the nature-nurture discussion, Chapter 7, as Kaufer and Francis point out, environments can be as deterministic as we once believed only genes could be, and the genome can be as malleable as we once believed only environments could be. And the basic message of this book has been that there is substantial evidence that we can be active agents who in part control how those interactions play out. That leaves us with a view of human nature in which we potentially have more choice and more responsibility than in the purely deterministic scientific views of the past century. Those views attributed the causes of our behavior to the environment, DNA, the unconscious, bad parenting, or evolution, plus chance. The story this book tells acknowledges all these sources as influences, but ultimately, at the end of that causal chain, it is the individual who is the agent of the action and decides when to ring the bell. When I'm asked to summarize the fundamental message from research on self-control, I recall Descartes' famous dictum, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. What has been discovered about mind, brain, and self-control lets us move from his proposition to, I think, therefore I can change what I am. Because by changing how we think, we can change what we feel, do, and become. If that leads to the question, but can I really change? I reply with what George Kelly said to his therapy clients when they kept asking him if they could get control of their lives. He looked straight into their eyes and said, "Would you like to?"
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Marshmallow Test, Mastering Self-Control, by Walter Mischel. Copyright 2014 by Walter Mischel. Performed by Alan Alda. Directed by Lewis Milgram. Performance copyright 2014 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. Excerpts from David G. Meyer's Self-Serving Bias in This Will Make You Smarter, New Scientific Concepts to Improve Your Thinking, edited by John Brockman, New York Doubleday, 2012, 37-38, used with permission. Quotes from George Ramirez are printed with permission. Excerpts from Sesame Street script for episode 4412 are reprinted with permission. Sesame Workshop, Sesame Street, and associated characters, trademarks, and design elements are owned and licensed by Sesame Workshop. Copyright 2014 by Sesame Workshop. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.